I declare the meeting open at 5:30 PM. I welcome councillors, management, members of the public in attendance to the City of Melbourne. We respectfully acknowledge that we are meeting on the traditional land of the Kulin Nation. This place is now known by the name of Melbourne. Melbourne is one of the great multicultural cities of the world and a significant meeting place. For the Kulin Nation, Melbourne has always been an important meeting place and a location for events of social, educational, sporting and cultural significance. I take this opportunity to notify members of the public that the meeting is being recorded and will be made available on the City of Melbourne's website before close of business tomorrow. The unconfirmed minutes of the meeting will be available from the City of Melbourne's website as soon as practicable. Should there be any queries relating to the conduct of the meeting, the documentation or the submission process, please speak with a member of the Council business team after the meeting. Could I ask that all mobile phones be turned off for the duration of the meeting? The agenda comprises 5 reports from management and 6 items of general business. No apologies have been received. I advise members of the committee and the public that where the committee makes a decision on the basis of 6 members voting in favour, the decision may be referred by a councillor to council for decision. If any councillor has either a direct or indirect interest as defined in the Local Government Act 1989 in relation to a matter to be considered by committee, please disclose the type and the nature of the interest prior to consideration of the item. Could I call on a councillor to move a resolution adopting the minutes of open meeting number 50 held on Tuesday the 9th of December 2014? Deputy Lord Mayor, seconded Councillor Foster. I'll put that motion. All those in favour? Sorry, councillors, you either have to vote, abstain, or in favour. Are there any matters arising from the minutes of the previous meeting? As at 3 PM today, the following submissions were received in accordance with the Council's conduct of meetings local law. In relation to agenda item 6.1, planning permit application for 35 to 37 Barnett Street, Kensington, requests to speak from Morel Bull, David Stribley, James Thomas, Kate Gamble, Jeffrey Topp, Chris Page, Tom Ryan and Edith Hookey, and items of correspondence from Morel Bull, Matt Connell, Jared Soares, Florence Soares, Jane Leafman, Ryan and Kirsten O'Keefe, Rachel Stevens and Ulrich Hansen, Tanya Rotino, Andrew Schaefer and Bianca Schirripa, John Buckingham, Helen Blakey, Tom Ryan and Belinda Farrant, Anne Grayson, Chris Page, Jeffrey Topp and Kate Gamble, Andrew Hollow and Annie Grayson. In relation to agenda item 6.1A, planning application for 529 to 541 Elizabeth Street, request to speak from Graham Poole, Lloyd Elliott, Judy Cowan, Belinda Burkamp and Lynn Nicholson. In relation to agenda item 6.2, Melbourne for All People, implementing monitoring and evaluation plan, item of correspondence from Lucy Firth. In relation to agenda item 7.5, a notice of motion from Councillor Oak, Sunlight to Public Spaces, a request to speak from Paul Rosa, and items of correspondence from Ray Cowling and Lucy Firth. In relation to agenda item 7.6, notice of motion from Councillor Main on the land tax, fire services levy and congestion tax, request to speak from Carl Fitzgerald, an item of correspondence from Lucy Firth. Is there anybody who'd like to speak to any agenda item whose name I have not read out? You're more than welcome to. We just add your name to the list. Yes?
Well, Mayor, you mentioned my name, Jeffrey Topper, speaking with the first agenda item.
Yep.
I would welcome.
Thanks, Jeff. Yeah, sorry. Sure. Okay. Thank you very much. We have a policy where at the start of every council meeting, a 15-minute period is set aside for members of the public to ask us questions. Questions should not be greater than 90 seconds of duration. This is not the time to make submissions or indeed to speak to any agenda item that we are considering tonight. Is there any member of the public who would like to ask us a question? Please. Yep, please. And if you tell us your name, and then please go ahead.
My name's Sarah Bergen. Since March 2014...
You don't need to stand up, I promise you. I'll call you one by one, that's fine.
Council have been notified of at least 19 breaches of the Code of Practice for the operation of horse-drawn carriages. These breaches range from no display of permit plates and non-compliance with road safety rules to compromising amenity. In addition, there have been 4 instances of an operator street trading without a permit, which is in breach of Council's activities local law. Ourselves and other complainants have never received a response from Council that would indicate these issues are being adequately addressed. We have collected in excess of 3,500.
This is not the time for a submission, as
I'm just
said.
Providing some
context, this is
Lord
not the time
Mayor,
for a submission.
And I'm almost at my question.
It's the time for a question.
We have collected in excess of 3,500 signatures against this practice. Over 30,000 people have watched a YouTube clip of an aggressive and dangerous horse-drawn carriage operator. When will Council review the operation of horse-drawn carriages within the City of Melbourne, as it is clear the industry is unregulated? There are insufficient resources within Council's compliance team to ensure the code of practice is complied with, and a large section of the community will no longer tolerate the unavoidable animal welfare issues associated with this practice.
Thank you. Could I make a... You're welcome to stay there. I'm happy to respond. We do review continually. The YouTube video to which you refer, my understanding is that is a horse-drawn carriage that is not a part of the City of Melbourne, and therefore one that we cannot regulate because the journey is booked and starts from outside the City of Melbourne and they are free to do so, and I think you should be plain about that. My understanding is the police declined to press charges because they'd have to actually press charges against the cyclist who filmed it as well, and we weren't sure that we wanted that to happen, but that's the police advice to us. No good shaking your head. That's the police advice to us. I'm answering your question. So that is our advice so far. The code of conduct is there for the vehicles that are registered to pick up within the City of Melbourne. There is a much larger industry than that. I'm not saying I'm in favour of this by any means, nor their behaviour, but I think that your target in some ways is us when you don't necessarily understand the powers that we have to actually make them comply, and that is our difficulty. Can I assure you, our officers are assiduous in attempting to follow up that code of conduct. We have removed one licence, but there are many others who operate from outside the city who are not beholden to the City of Melbourne at all, and that situation continues. I applaud your passion about this issue, but again, I don't applaud your bombarding of me on talkback radio without identifying yourselves, but nevertheless, I still answer those questions. We will continue to monitor those operators for whom we are responsible, but our powers are remarkably limited, as you know. But again, to refer continually to that YouTube video when Victoria Police advice to us is different, and indeed the operator is not one of those from the City of Melbourne, doesn't do your case much good.
Lord Mayor, may I respond briefly?
No.
That operator is in breach of your activities local law because he is street trading continuously out the front of this town hall.
No. Thank you. I will take that on notice, and I will attempt to give you an answer in writing as a part of your question. Are there any further questions for us? In that case, could I call on Councillor Ong to assume the role of chair of the meeting in relation to the planning portfolio?
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Tonight we have 2 reports from management for consideration under the planning portfolio. One of them is deferred from last week, which we'll address next. First agenda item. The planning permit application TP 2014-41, which is number 35-37 Barnett Street, Kensington. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item?
Yes, please.
May I then call Daniel Susan, planning coordinator, to make a brief presentation.
Lord Mayor and Councillors, this is an application at 35 and 37 Barnett Street in Kensington. It's an application for 5 townhouses constructed in part 2 and part 3 storey form across the site. It involves the demolition of a property that is proposed to be graded under the Kensington Heritage Review. It also is in an area that's located within the general residential zone, Schedule 2, which by ministerial amendment introduced a mandatory 8-metre height control. That mandatory 8-metre height control applies to applications lodged after the gazettal of the amendment. There are transitional provisions that say that we must consider the application having regard to the planning controls as they existed prior to the gazettal of the amendment. I'll take you through some of the plans. Perhaps. So, the subject site, 35 and 37 Barnett Street. 35 is the... Oh, here we are. Oh, I've got it. Sorry. 35 is the property that's proposed to be included in the on the heritage inventory with a D grading, and 37 is not. 37 is a double width property, 35 single width. 35 is here. It's an existing Victorian dwelling. It has been altered, so it's not in pristine condition. And 37 Barnett Street is a brick building, so circa 50s or 60s probably, and it has no particular heritage significance. Some of the submissions have been focused on the single-storey character of Barnett Street. There are single-storey properties in Barnett Street. There are heritage properties in Barnett Street. There are also a series of two-storey developments in the immediate area. So this is just an indication of some of the more modern developments and extensions within the area. 40 to 44 Barnett Street, which is that top left-hand image, not a fantastic piece of architecture, but sits immediately across the road. This is a perspective image of the proposal. It looks like three dwellings across the front of the site. It is in fact a single dwelling. I'll come to that in the plans in a moment. But it's been designed with three separate gable ends to mimic the form of heritage properties in the street, albeit at a higher scale. It's another view. It's a very contemporary piece of architecture. It's not pretending to be something that it's not, both in terms of its the use of materials and in terms of its form. This is a floor plan, and so this is the southern boundary running through here, northern boundary along here, Barnett Street on the left-hand side of the page. The proposal includes a driveway running along the southern boundary with access to a series of four car parking spaces for the four units here, and a carport access via Barnett Street, and a setback with a series of north-facing private open spaces to those apartments there. There is a small section of wall constructed along the eastern boundary, which is adjacent to one of the neighbouring properties, which is adjacent to a shed on that property. The building is otherwise set back at the ground floor a short distance, which provides for an entry pathway to the dwelling. And the front dwelling, which is has the three peaked gabled roofs, is laid out in that manner, with a sort of a front yard presentation to the street. First floor level, a series of bedrooms, living areas for the central units. And then the third floor is not the whole of the site. This is why I said part two and part three. The third floor is set back some distance from the street edge. And it is these two apartments have a third floor. There is also a roof deck proposed for the second apartment and for the fourth apartment. That's a roof plan. And this is an illustration, a streetscape elevation. There's been some criticism of the fact that this area was not shaded in the plans. This is an elevation drawing. It's not what you will see from the street. It's a two-dimensional representation of what the building would look like. So what you will see from the street is this, and there's some 3D images that will show how much, and some perspective images that will show how much of this upper level will be visible. It will be more visible on oblique views, but not from directly across the opposite side of the street. These lines here, these dotted lines, represent the Res Code, or Clause 55, setback standard, the numerical standard under the Residential Design Code that says how far a building should be set back, and you can see that it complies with that, or more than exceeds the requirements of that in both cases. And again, there's the dotted line. This is the rear of the property, the front of the property, and it complies, or more than complies, with the residential design standards in terms of that setback. That's the south elevation of the property. And the northern elevation, for completeness, the rear elevation, or the east elevation. And this is the sectional diagram I was referring to. This is the gable end here at the point of, and this is the lowest point of that gable. So when you're looking over the peak of the roof, you clearly won't see the addition. When you're looking over the lower point of the roof, you might begin to see part of the upper level part, but only to a limited extent by virtue of the setback and by virtue of this this height. What this diagram also does is demonstrate the overlooking requirements under the residential design standards. Unreasonable overlooking is deemed to be views within 9 metres that are visible to the ground. This diagram demonstrates that within 9 metres there are no views to the ground of the adjoining properties to the east. So in that respect, it complies with the standard and therefore the objectives of Res Code.
Thank you, Daniel. Any questions for Daniel? If not, oh yes, Lord Mayor.
Overall, Daniel, would you say that this development complies with Res Code?
Yes, it complies with the objectives of Res Code.
Thank you.
Councillor Leppard has one question to Daniel.
Except for height.
The numerical standard of height is 9 metres under the residential, the Clause 55 provisions. The objective of Res Code is that the building height respects the character of the area. So the standard, it doesn't comply with the technical standard. The 9.5 metres is 450 mil higher, about that much higher than what the standard would allow. But we say, given the location of that height and its relationship to the front of the dwelling, its neighbours, the compliance with the setbacks, that it complies with the objective of Res Code in terms of the character and amenity considerations.
Thank you, Daniel. You may take a seat. Right, I would now call on the presenters. As the Lord Mayor said, you have 3 minutes. There'll be a beeper that sounds up to two, and you have 1 minute to wind up. First, I call on David Stribley to address the committee.
Okay, so thank you for allowing me to speak tonight. My family and I live at 37 Barnett Street, the site of the proposed development you just saw then, and my brother and his partner live at 35 Barnett Street, and I will be representing us both this evening. I'd like to talk to you about why I feel this is a good development for the area and how it is in keeping with the neighbourhood character. We've enjoyed living in Kensington since 2009. I work in the CBD, I have a small child, and I usually ride to and from work, and my wife walks and catches public transport most places. Since the arrival of our baby last year, my wife and I have access to many services and supports provided by the council. The library, shops, maternal, child health nurse, pools, parks, public transport, all within a very short walking distance from our home. Kensington is a well-planned area with good services. In order for Melbourne to grow sustainably, infill and greater density in areas such as Kensington is essential. It is for these reasons that I believe this proposal is a good development for the area. I appreciate the need to maintain historical and neighbourhood character whilst trying to balance the increased requirements of a growing city like Melbourne. We have worked with Melbourne City Council and tried to address concerns from neighbours by making changes to the original proposal that you saw today. In particular, concerns regarding parking, overshadowing, overlooking, the visual bulk have all tried to be addressed. The proposal has been reduced from an original 6 townhouse development to what you saw today of 5. We've increased the setback from Barnett Street, again, to address visual bulk. We've made changes to the built form at the rear, again, to try and address visual bulk. The resulting plans are well within Res Code requirements and relatively low inner city density at only 58% site coverage. In regards to traffic, I would also like to note that the council traffic engineers have reviewed this proposal and have no concerns with it. In regards to orientation, though the north-south orientation was unusual for the street, the orientation was deliberately chosen. It increased side setbacks from neighbours, reducing the visual bulk, overshadowing, and overlooking potential of the development. provided good natural light for proposed residents in line with clause 55, provided good design solutions to off-street parking, limiting any more required crossovers. In regards to the design, we've designed the building facade so that it is in keeping with existing streetscape where pitched roofs and alleyways are prevalent. I would argue it is more appropriate than our current cream brick house, as you saw. If it goes ahead, the building will contribute to the greater housing stock at Kensington. It will provide a new and interesting contribution to the architectural character of the area, and it will be a great home to live in a great area. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Any questions for the speaker? Nope. You may take a seat. I next call on Morrell Bull to address the committee.
Thank you. So there are three broad bases upon which I'm objecting to the grant of the planning permit. The significant adverse impacts on the certain residents that are on the adjoining properties in Barnett and Collett Streets. The significant adverse impacts on the local neighbourhood more generally, including me and my family down the road in Barnett Street. And the procedural issues, both issues with the application itself and also the assessment by the planning team. So first, the issues relating to the residents, I'll let them mostly speak to those. But as my written submission indicates, I think there are substantial issues that reduce the privacy for those residents. I believe the substantial overlooking created by the property is not accurately reflected in the application itself. I note that the overlooking into 33 Barnett is not dealt with at all. The overlooking into 41 Barnett Street is not dealt with adequately. There is no shadowed figure shown in the drawings overlooking into that property on the plans. The overlooking into the three Collett Street properties, I also submit, will be substantial. I don't know about your eyesight, but I can certainly see beyond 9 metres. And I understand one of the residents there has an open sort of window, which is quite high up. So you can't put curtains there to protect the privacy, and that's their main living area. So it would be able to see directly into that from the rooftop terraces. There's also going to be noise impacts, which I consider to be material, particularly for 41 Barnett Street. Secondly, so the issues more generally in relation to the local neighbourhood. I submit that a structure of 9.45 metres in total height is not in keeping with the general neighbourhood. Whilst I note the slide presentation did indicate there is a two-storey property just across the road, I understand that there is actually a laneway behind that property, so there's an adequate setback to the neighbouring adjoining properties in Rankin's Road. I also consider the structure will be visually jarring with the rest of the streetscape and not in keeping with it at all. And I also consider it will detract generally from the amenity and the heritage character of the area. I also, as detailed on page 4 of my submission, I submit that it's inconsistent with various planning laws and policies in place, notwithstanding the fact that the heritage amendment is not yet gazetted. I consider that the substance of the review has been completed, and the applicant should have been well aware of that prior to purchasing the second property and as a resident of the local area. And just finally on the procedural issues, so I note those on page 5 in respect to the application, although I note that today's presentation did shed a bit more light on the finishers issues. And I think there's a bit of a disconnect in the paper prepared by the planning team as to the substance, what's in the body versus the conclusions. And I've just got one more or a few points.
Thank you. You may take your seat now.
Okay.
Next, I would like to call James Thomas to address the committee.
Great, thank you. My young family and I reside at 33 Barnett Street, which is directly to the north of the proposed development. The key reasons for our objection to this application in its current form are as follows. Firstly, impact on our privacy and the noise. As with all existing surrounding properties, we have a private rear courtyard, which my family and I currently have the pleasure of enjoying. The north-south orientation of the development, in addition to the height of the proposed development and the existence of north-facing balconies and a rooftop terrace, will create significant overlooking and privacy concerns for not just our property but all surrounding properties. I note that in section one of the report to the FMC, subject site and surrounds, which is on page 18, it makes no reference to our private courtyard, which is close to 40 square metres in size, whilst the overlooking drawings provided on page 12 appear to show no consideration of the overlooking to our private courtyard for either the north-facing balconies or from the rooftop terrace. The proposal shows little consideration or concern for the impact the additional people noise will have on surrounding residents, with the rooftop terrace and north and south facing balconies likely to severely accentuate any noise emanating from the property. Second point is out of keeping with existing streetscape and heritage. The proposed development height of 9.45 metres is significantly higher than any other residential development on Barnett Street, as shown in the drawings on page 10 of the report, and exceeds the 9 metre height limit requirement as per general residential zoning. In addition, it does not meet the council's strategic decision to limit future development in this street to 8 metres as per the C179 amendment resulting in Schedule 2 of the general residential zone. The diagrams also illustrate in stark detail the change in streetscape which would occur should the development go ahead, with changes in height and space between the dwellings to the immediate north and south of the site being prominent. Section 14.2 of the report, built form and design, on page 30 states the two-storey built form will be higher than many of the single-fronted dwellings further to the south of the site. I would argue that the proposed development would be higher than all residential properties to the south and to the north of the site on Barnett Street. The discrepancy in height between the development and adjoining properties is obvious and significant. As the heritage referral states in Appendix 3 of the report, page 48, number 35 Barnett Street is defined as a contributory building within the heritage review undertaken for the amendment C215. Losing a building of this nature could impact future heritage reviews of the street by reducing the perceived heritage value. Section 14.1 of the report, demolition, attempts to provide justification for the demolition in part by claiming the replacement building is considered to meet the intent of heritage policy.
And thank you. Mr. Thomas. I call on the next speaker, Kate Gamble, to address the committee.
Where is the... I've got a couple of images. Sorry. Oh, here. So it's just... Okay, so this one's finding this for me. Okay, so sorry, which moves the slide? Just the front one, just the top one. The arrows, yeah. I live at 64 Collette Street, abutting the proposed development to the east. I work in this industry, I have taught urban design, and like other objectors here, I understand and support the aims of densification that council adheres to. We are not planners or architects, but we've sought extensive independent advice on this application from architectural, urban design, and planning professionals across academia, private practice, and from other councils. All have unequivocally and unanimously nominated the same key concerns that should lead to your rejection of this proposal. The application has substantive problems regarding scale and bulk, clear detrimental impact to the amenity of adjacent properties, disregards the existing urban fabric, undermines character, and shows contempt for the aims of the Heritage Amendment C215. The proposal's bulk and scale will impact significantly on adjoining properties, particularly to the rear of the development, though this seems to not have been considered at all, and rates barely are mentioned in the delegate's report, other than to note the application has endeavoured to meet the standard of Res Code in this regard. This proposal undermines or runs counter to almost each and every point of the strategic framework section of the delegate's report, and as all consultants have emphasised to us, should be clear grounds for its rejection. And yet somehow council planning staff is at odds with this body of expertise on each of these contentious points. The sheer scale and bulk is clear and apparent. It's clear and apparent, requires little elaboration except to say that a few measures to mitigate bulk have been employed. From the rear, this development is monolithic, presenting largely as a blank wall. It is nonsensical to suggest that this meets the objectives as set out under clause 22.17. How on earth a professional in this field can suggest that this structure even remotely addresses objectives that require the scale, siting and mass of the structure to complement and not overwhelm the existing context is extraordinary. It is as sympathetic as a Bunnings building from the rear. How does this complement prevailing patterns of height and scale in this context? The competency and rigour with which this application has been managed and assessed must be called into question, given the significant lack of reasoning employed to justify a recommendation to approve, as shown on this single issue, and as this is repeated across every substantive issue. Our consultants have been stunned by the easy progression of this application through planning so far. Recent experience alarms further. On Thursday, the planning officer advised in writing the screen to the rear a roof terrace was 1.7 metres, clearly resolving overlooking to our secluded private open space and habitable areas. On Monday, the officer revised this to 1.54 metres in height, finally settling on 1.32 metres in height, which is the true effective screening height, not 1.7 metres. This is absolutely insufficient, leaving our secluded private open space and living areas totally exposed, and I'm told is a clear and defendable detriment to amenity despite being outside of 9 metres. The drawings submitted are unclear and confusing, but that the planning officer is unclear about something as straightforward as the height of screening at this stage of the process simply reinforces the overriding impression of a complete lack of rigour that must draw the propriety of this recommendation into question. As far as I can see, the only possible decision remaining is to reject the application.
Thank you, Ms Campbell. Can you just hold on? There's a question for you.
Kate, do you see any merit in anything in the 50-page report?
Could I see any merit in...
Do you see any merit in anything in the 50-page report? Do you see any merit in anything in the 50-page delegate's report?
Well, it completely contradicts all the advice that we've received at almost every point.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So it's really that's been my
thank
concern.
You.
It's really difficult.
Yes, sir. Councillor Wood has a question too, Kate.
So with this complying with the objectives of Res Code, are you suggesting we're going against Res Code here? We throw out the Res Code compliance, or? So you're saying that even though it meets Res Code, you think we should still?
Thank you. Thank you. I will now call on Chris Page to address the committee.
Thank you. My name is Chris Page. I'm speaking on behalf of myself, my wife, who unfortunately, due to working requirements, cannot be here this evening. We have submitted a written objection to outlining our main points to our objection, so I will not repeat them all in the 3 minutes. I've other to say that we purchased our property at 41 Barnett Street, which is immediately adjacent to 37, in 1982, when after renting in Hawthorne, we discovered Kensington and immediately wanted to live there. The often quoted real estate blurb about a village atmosphere was evident and still is, mainly because of the size and scale of the streetscape. We feel this will be destroyed by allowing a building this size, bulk and height to dominate the skyline and dwarf the surrounding houses. The prevailing orientation of all the houses and streets are east-west, but this development is orientated 90 degrees, so the open spaces are on the side of the building and building to the rear boundary, which is at odds with the prevailing streetscape. Ourselves, James and Kate live at 33, would in fact have 5 neighbours instead of the present one. The rear of all our properties on the eastern side of Barnett Street are separated from Collett Street by fences and have private open spaces all in the way to the fence line. There is no laneway, affecting setback as there is in other streets in Kensington, as for example on the western side of the street. Therefore, this building would loom over all of us and remove any privacy which we now enjoy. We would be overlooked in our rear garden because it's on the northern side, also overshadowed. We had considered solar panels, however, there would not be much use as being shadowed for most of the time, especially in the winter months. Our boundary wall, which forms the wall of our living space, abuts the proposed driveway to the garages and was not built to absorb the noise from cars or the possible impact from them. No mentions made on the plans to deal with this issue. We're not averse to development. However, this proposal is too large and imposing on the streetscape. Maybe something like 3 two-storey townhouses would be more suitable and I'm sure would raise no objections. I find it hard to believe that we've come this far regarding this development, and the planning department has seen fit to approve its design and effect on the street. I've shown the plans to a lot of people, both professional and lay people, all say there is no way they can or should be approved. A final note, I have a copy of the current Melbourne magazine, which has an article regarding better designs for heritage building, including streetscapes and residential neighbourhoods. It says, amongst other things, I quote, "As our city's population grows, we want to ensure that subsequent building growth is well designed and managed, and we need to protect that value." Fine words, and ones we all agree with. So how can this building be allowed to proceed in a street, say, like Barnett Street, as it's surely at odds with these objectives? Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. I call on Tom Ryan next to address the committee.
Should be a diagram, thank you. Down, sorry, the streetscape, go down one more, sorry. It was attached in a separate document, apologies. Yep, if we go up, I just want to point out something that the planning office pointed out. So that's the plan that was provided to us. If you scroll the page up, please, or down, sorry, I should say. We went reverse. That is the grey shaded area. The reason why I point this out is if you scroll to the next article, next one down, I'll put it in near line of sight. I disagree that your lowest point is it there. If I refer to the plans, the box gutter is where I run that red line through, which clearly shows that from the street, the property will be visible at the height. I suggest you check the elevations. I may be reading it wrong because I'm not an architect, but I don't think it runs through that midpoint that you're pointing out. I also point out that the urban plan requested oblique views. I requested these oblique views from the council. The oblique views that were provided were those that were put in the initial submission, and the urban planner requested that they see additional oblique views to show how that streetscape would be shown from Barnett Street. They were not provided, and I can't see how the planning officer can make a decision without seeing those extra oblique views. Further to the point of heritage that James raised, I also note that the property is or is intended to be under a heritage plan. And during the review, an independent consultant, Graham Butler, and associates successfully argued against the applicant's objection to include Barnett Street South within the heritage precinct, including that number 35 in his argument states that removing places included in Mr. Stribley's submission would propose difficulties for heritage management. Mr. Butler also stated the building at 35 Barnett Street was contributed to the heritage significance of the proposed northern boundary extension to Barnett Street residential precinct H01163. The independent appointed the Minister for Planning and supported Mr. Butler in his decision. I further note that the applicant tried to have this property removed from the heritage zone and it was unsuccessful. I'd like to point out our objection is not to that the property doesn't meet res code. It's the fact that it doesn't meet neighbourhood character. We've all seen the pictures of the streetscape. It's predominantly single fronted with houses with their boundaries set on one side. This property takes one allotment, joins them together, puts it in the middle with a driveway either side or open space, and completely changes the form of the street. I also point out that all the backyards are small, but joined together, they make one large open area. If you develop to the back boundary like this property intends, it removes a large green open space that we enjoy as a private area. Large developments of this scale are predominantly built on areas with a rear laneway that gives a further open space. This area doesn't have that benefit, and I think that's why a property of this scale isn't appropriate and would be more appropriate to an area with a laneway. All my colleagues or neighbours have addressed some clear points about this development. It's clear that it's not in line with neighbourhood character, it's clear that elements have been overlooked, and it's clear that the urban planner has requested more information. Simply, in my view, and I would like to quote something, that the property does not comply with the Council's municipal strategic statement and local planning policy with regard to ensuring height and scale of development is appropriate to the built form character of an area and to ensure residential development in Kensington maintains its generally low scale and nature of heritage. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Let me take a seat. Finally, I call Enid Hookey to address the committee.
Thank you, councillors. I wish to speak to this application as a resident of Barnett Street in the block one removed from the
application site. My property is within the same heritage precinct, HO 1163, that has been proposed and adopted by council under Planning Amendment C215. I also wish to speak about MSS C190, the Arden-Macaulay planning vision, and lastly, the heritage review in more detail. Next slide, please. The MSS, firstly, I think the constituents of Kensington were pleased to receive a stable area classification for all of Kensington's residential zones when the MSS was adopted and gazetted. Stable is defined in the MSS as having little or no capacity for change or to the population or to the neighbourhood character. Population growth per the MSS is to be targeted to urban renewal areas, and that is under the vision of the C190 Arden-Macaulay structure plan. Next slide, please. I've reviewed this proposal, taking its site area, its potential population, with a very modest assumption of one person or one resident per bedroom, and found that the population density represented by this particular proposal would be 12 times what is represented by a standard residential block in Box Hill. The reason for this extreme density in Kensington is because the allotments are tiny, and when you attempt to increase from two dwellings to five dwellings on a confined allotment, where all around you there is similarly small allotments, the result is high population density that cannot be. It's not within the capacity of the street. There will be amenity impacts to those surrounding, as has been described. Next slide, please. The planning amendment C214, C215 has been reviewed by planning panel. The precincts recommended, the new precinct, Barnett Street North and Barnett Street South, are important and have been described by councillors as fascinating document, something that will bring the community together. I can provide the minutes of the meeting where this was said. This, in fact, is true if the heritage precinct is supported by planning, but we can see in this case that the planning officer has underplayed the heritage aspects and has attempted to... Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Main would like to ask Daniel one question.
Yeah, Daniel, I'm interested if you wish to respond to any of the points made by any of our submitters, but I'd also like you to specifically address the effectiveness of the conditions in terms of screening and privacy.
Of course. That's an open-ended... I took some notes, so I'm not necessarily going to... Perhaps I'll start with the last one. There was a submission made just by Ms. Hookey about the stable residential areas and that was limited or no change. The MSS does not say limited or no change. The MSS says in these areas limited change, such as, amongst other things, infill development, will continue to occur. So that's the definition of stable residential areas as it appears in the MSS. In terms of, there was a submission made, I'm going to jump around a little bit, and if there's a particular item you wanted me to address, I'm happy to. Submission made with respect to the gable end and the visibility of the sight line diagram. The image, the point at which the submitter had made the point was actually to the top of the window on the north elevation. The top of the window to the north elevation is about 600 mil lower than the height of the lowest point of the gable of the end of the roof. So the diagram is correct in its depiction of the views that will be visible from immediately across the street. The submitter was also critical of the fact that we didn't have oblique views presented to us. We did have oblique views presented to us. They're the same oblique three-dimensional montages that have been presented to you tonight that showed the image from oblique angles up and down Barnett Street.
I think that's the issue.
screening.
And the screening heights, yes.
So the screening height is 1.342 metres. That's correct. In terms of the criticism that was levelled at the planning officer, I'd just like to defend him, if I may. This report was prepared in the start of November last year. It's been 3.5 months. 2 days ago or 3 days ago, an email came through to him and he responded and then he clarified. So to be fair, it was just a mistake because it's been a significant amount of time since he prepared that report and there's been a number of reports in between. It is not a reflection on the competency of that officer, and I think his report reflects that. In terms of the screening, 1.342 metres, the nature of the screening device that has been proposed is, as demonstrated in the sections, a screening device that comes up and out away from the view. So it's 1.342 metres high, but it sits about here. So what it does is it prevents your view down, and it forces your view out. You can't do that. You can't look straight down because it's blocking that view. So whilst it's not 1.7 metres high, it's been specifically designed to ensure it doesn't provide views within 9 metres to those properties to the east or indeed to the property to the north. So it complies with the objective of ResCode. This is what I go back to. It doesn't comply with the numerical standard. The numerical standard would say stick a 1.7 metre high screen on it. This does the same thing in a different manner.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's an important point. That's it. Councillor Watts, you'd like to ask Daniel a question?
Daniel, of course. Does ResCode say anything about it? I'm interested in the submitter's reference to there not being a laneway behind, which contributes to this sense they have that they're going to be very blocked in and yes. Overlooked. Does ResCode say anything about that? That's one thing I want to find out about.
Yes.
And the other point that struck me was one of the submitters saying from having one set of neighbours, he's now going to have five. And I note that of those five, they're going to have cars and they're going to have garage doors, which are going to go up and down and be noisy. Does ResCode say anything about the noise from the garage door point of view?
So two points. The first point, in terms of the laneway. ResCode says, with respect to laneways, and there's two provisions, walls on boundaries and side and rear setbacks. So side and rear setbacks is that envelope that was shown. A wall on a boundary is where there's a wall on a boundary. In both standards, the ResCode specifically says, if it abuts a laneway, that you should consider whether or not you can vary the standard. So the standard is this. If you want to vary that standard, if it's next to a laneway, then you might vary that standard. So, for instance, the maximum height of a wall on a boundary is 3.6 metres under the standard. If it's abutting a laneway, then you might accept a wall of 6 metres in height because you take into account the width of the laneway when you're considering what the separation distance is. So this particular scheme complies with ResCode without exceeds the requirements of ResCode without the laneway there. In terms of that bulk, because I might just address that, some of the images that you were presented with, goes back to that two-dimensionality. That's what you would see if you were looking at a plan and you superimpose the plan on the back of a photograph. In reality, that is not what will be seen because there are setbacks there for the upper levels. So that's what I would say. I'd question the accuracy of those images. In terms of the second point, which was
the garage doors.
So ResCode does make comments about residential noise. But it's actually about noise within a development. So it's about the provision of a driveway and the need to protect residents within their own development from noise from within that driveway. And it says things like you should raise the sill height of windows where they face a driveway so that you don't have a direct noise impact if there's a bedroom onto the driveway. In this particular case, there's a boundary fence that separates the two properties. There may be residential noise from a garage door opening in the morning or in the evening when people leave to go or come from work, but the ResCode doesn't have anything particular to say about that. The tribunal have made consistent decisions about residential noise, and they have said that residential noise from unit developments, irrespective of the nature or number of those unit developments, is no different than residential noise caused by any other residential neighbour. This is mainly with respect to having parties in backyards or barbecues or increased density of population. In terms of the garages, all I could say is that the garages are set back a distance from the boundary and there will be a boundary fence separating the two.
Thank you, Daniel. You can take a seat. I now call on councillor to move a motion. Councillor Main moves the motion on the screen. I call the councillor to second the motion. Councillor Wood. Would the mover like to speak to the motion?
Yes, thanks, Councillor Ong. Look, I'd like to support the officer recommendation and move the officer report. I think the opening point to make is that something is going to happen on this site. So it's a three-lot site, if you like, and it's good riddance to an ugly 1950s brick building to start with at 37 Barnett Street, so which the report notes is detrimental to the amenity of the street. So something's going to happen, and the question is what? And I think if you look at where we started with a six dwelling proposal, I think it's good that the applicant has consulted. We've had a very intense consultation. We've had a reduced application, and then I think we've had some appropriate conditions that deal with the screening issues. I think it's interesting to note that the setback at the front is 4 metres, and some of the neighbours, the setbacks are only, I think, less than about 1.5. So the setbacks are generous, and because it is the three-lot site, effectively, you can have greater setbacks. So the purchase of the additional property allows for greater setbacks. So overall, I think that the officer report is very complimentary on the architectural work here on offer, that it's a well-designed building, that it's going to fit in nicely into an eclectic street, which does have some mixed proposals and some townhouses directly across the road. And I think the other point I'd make is that whilst we do need to be sensitive to seriously entertained proposals such as C179 and C215, that we do have to deal with the planning rules in place at the time that the application was lodged. And the Minister's recent gazettal of some amendments make that clear. And so as regulators here, effectively, as a responsible authority, they are the rules we have to follow. So we can't actually reach down and say there's the 8 metres at C179 now, when the rules at the time were the 9, and we've obviously had the response about how the 9.45 can be justified. So I get a sense that this will probably finish up at VCAT, and I know that councils generally don't have a good record when they roll their offices, their professional planning offices, where you have two positions from the Council of VCAT, the professional officer position, and then a different political elected reps position done on nights such as this. And as Deputy Chair of the Planning Committee, I think it is important that we support our professional officers in what is, I think, a well-considered and well-written report after good consultations, some sensible compromises from the applicant. Thank all the submitters for coming. I think there's been some good arguments. I suspect we haven't heard the last of it, but from my position, I think this is an officer report and an application that deserves to be supported.
Thank you, Councillor Main. Councillor Wood, as the seconder.
Thanks, Councillor Ong. Just to pick up on a couple of points that Councillor Main made, and I think obviously this is a planning consideration before us, and we can only make a decision based on the planning rules that were in place at the time. I take the point that one of the buildings may have received a degrading, but effectively it hasn't been gazetted yet and wasn't gazetted at the time of the application. In terms of height, Schedule 2, which actually brought down those ceilings to 8 metres, was supposed to provide a transition time and effectively didn't. So that was a bit of a mistake by the Minister's office, and that was soon rectified, so that deals with that issue, and you heard Councillor Main talk about that additional height that was realised. So in effect, the site itself is not currently affected by any overlays that we can consider at a planning meeting such as this. So we have to consider the planning rules that were before us at the time. So the key planning considerations which our submitters have articulated well, and I think the passion that you've articulated your position is to be commended, will it adversely impact character, and is it compatible with the existing scale? And when we talk about the need to densify and what the strategic statement actually says about infill development, we have to understand that we're living in the fastest growing municipality in Australia. And that areas like Kensington will also have to densify to a certain extent. Officers consider the heritage or that dwelling that would be heritage graded of low value anyway. So even if it did achieve that grading, it would not guarantee that that wouldn't still be approved for demolition. And I think the other thing too, I just want to pick up on a point made by one of the submitters that this has had an easy progression. I'd probably not agree with that in the fact that there was an original proposal. There was a lot of objections, rightly so. The applicant then sought to work with those objectors and work through those objections, submitted some revised plans and received another round of objections. Then there was ministerial involvement. So I don't think this has exactly been an easy path. In terms of what the applicant's been willing to do, we've heard it all reduced the apartments from 6 to 5, additional screening on the balconies, which I think is absolutely critical, additional setbacks to the east, increasing the setback from Barnett Street, landscaping on the southern boundary, and a reconfiguration of the ground floor apartments for better amenity. The site coverage issue, the standard is no more than 60%. This sits at 58%, as you heard from the applicant. So in effect, this complies with res code. It complies with all the standards, with all the clauses, and that's what is before us. So, again, based on Councillor Main's points, I'm happy to support the officer recommendation on this one.
Thank you. Councillor Wood. Yeah, that was Councillor Wood. Yeah, thank you. Any speakers against the motion? Councillor Leppard.
Thank you, Chair. So the two planning scheme amendments that are relevant here is C215, the Heritage Review of Kensington, which is a seriously entertained planning scheme amendment, and so we actually do need to give it a lot of weight. C197, however, because of the transitionary clauses, directs us not to give those amendments any weight. So they're not in the same basket. C215, seriously entertained, so we do give a lot of weight. C197, we cannot give any weight because of the way this has worked. That's unusual, and I think it's caused a lot of confusion. The applicant has my sympathies in this regard. The way that the minister brought about the change to residential zones was atrocious, and it was all done 5 minutes to midnight before caretaker. In fact, he directed the department to make and exhibit the changes during the caretaker period, but he made that direction just before the caretaker period, and a couple of days before the election, we saw what those changes were. They were highly politicised changes. They were also made on the run, and that was proven by the fact that there were no transitionary arrangements, and so the applicant does have my absolute sympathies. It hasn't been an easy run for the applicant in that regard, at least. Now, res code is inherently subjective, and all of the sub-clauses of clause 55 of the planning scheme aren't meant to be, you know, assessed one at a time, and if any of them don't meet, well then, hey presto, res code isn't met. You've got to take the broader picture on res code, and I absolutely accept that, but it's not correct to say that each component of res code, which is of course clause 55 in this instance, are met, because they're not all met. They are broadly met according to the delegate, and I accept that opinion, but it is not necessarily true to say that there is only one correct opinion there. You've got to weigh that up against the other considerations, including whether or not the fact that it doesn't comply with every single bit of res code means that the demolition of the heritage place is justified. You know, the planning scheme as a whole needs to be taken into account. There are lots of great stuff with this application. The setbacks, as Councillor Main mentioned, are excellent, and the 58% site coverage as well is very good. But the quibble I do have is that the development, by being sort of flipped to not face Barnett Street, but is more or less flipped 90 degrees so that there's new driveways on either side. The driveways result in a new style of dwellings in that area, in that block, has resulted in some unfortunate outcomes. I think the character in terms of the backyard character is something that should be taken into consideration. The way that the built form goes into that green wedge in the back there is unusual. The way that the built form will interrupt the rhythm of the street is absolutely significant, and the heritage advisor goes to some lengths to talk about this, and you only need to look at the diagram on page 30 to see what happens when the rhythm of the street is interrupted. I think that needs to be given quite a lot of weight. the off-street car parking as well is something that can be considered a character issue. So the character question is quite important. And of course, ResCode at its heart is a way of regulating character. It's all about residential character. The application is also slightly too high, 9.45 metres versus 9 metres. I take the delegate's point that assessed in the scheme of things that is okay, and I accept that this is a little bit of a grey area, and it's easy to go one way or the other, but on balance, I'm coming down on the side of saying that the character impacts on the immediate streetscape and the neighbourhood more broadly aren't justified. And therefore the threshold for demolition of 35 Barnett Street is not met because the property doesn't quite meet that threshold. And so on those three grounds, character, height and heritage, I would foreshadow a motion that if this motion is refused, is voted down, I will move a motion to refuse the application based on those three grounds. And if we can have a look at it now, that'd be brilliant. I'll just leave it up there as I make my conclusion. Can we please scroll down and have a look at the foreshadowed motion? Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Leppett. Any other speakers for the motion? Any speakers against the motion? Councillor Watts is speaking against.
I am speaking against the motion. My colleague has very eloquently covered the problems here. I would like to take issue with the way in which one of my colleagues has described this as a rolling over of our officers. That really doesn't do the process justice. There is no rolling over going on here. What's going on here, is, from my perspective, is that compliance is one thing, but benefit to the community is another. The design that we see before us, as my colleague has outlined, in my view, fails on three important levels. Compliant, in broadly, it might be. We can't afford to let this kind of thing continue. The design, as my colleague has said, is not in itself poor, but it's superficially not much better than those nasty six packs we've seen all over the inner suburbs, where cars are lined up and people get multiple neighbours rather than one or two. This is simply an overdevelopment of the site and not a sympathetic one, no matter whether it has gables or not. So I'm very concerned that it will proceed.
Thank you, Councillor Watts. Any other speakers for the motion?
I don't speak for, I speak against it.
Yes.
I speak against the recommendation on heritage grounds, and that I do believe that it is contrary to the objectives of C215, and that we do need to seriously entertain the heritage review that we recently conducted. And I speak on this matter alone with respect to this application, just to be consistent in that I have spoken on this topic before, and my concern about heritage graded properties being demolished in our inner city suburbs, and that is a concern to me of number 35 being demolished as part of this application.
Thank you, Councillor Oak. Lord Mayor, you speak for the motion.
I'm quite astonished by some of this discussion. I understand the passion of those living nearby and they put their case well, but I think our plan has answered that case, in particular about the accuracy of some of the claims. You have to ask, given our overarching policies around the MSS and intensification, if you don't approve this, what would you approve? What would you approve? Because this concurs in all elements, as our planners have told us. As for protecting buildings, we voted unanimously to demolish a C-grade building in South Bank because it was next to the ABC, for the ABC expansion. So I don't think we can now come with clean hands to this and say we object to things which are listed to be listed, to be D-grade listed. I just think that this is the worst sort of populism, and it happens every time in Kensington. And I regret to say that is not the fault of the residents. You know, I think it is councillors who say, on the one hand, we support the general principles of the strategies we set down, but when individual things arise, we wish to actually curry favour with the people who come here. And I think that's holding out false hope, because I think what you're doing is saying, we trust that those who don't live or have their vote base in Kensington will vote for this, so the right decision will be made. But we have the luxury of being able to say we voted against it. And I think that that is unfortunate. And therefore, I support this, not because of that reason, but because this is good planning policy by our overarching standards and by all of the advice, not just of our statutory planners, and we make much of our pride in our urban design experts. Urban design also support this development. So unless you want to be an instant statutory planner or urban designer, why would you act against the advice of the experts who work for the City of Melbourne in both of those areas who support this development? And that's why I'm supporting it.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I'll speak for the motion, listening to the discussions, and I agree with some respects of what the Lord Mayor said. But first of all, I'd like to thank all the applicants.
Some respects.
Yes. I'd like to thank all the submitters, the applicant, for coming tonight and presenting it, the neighbourhood and the objectives of the concerns raised. I look at this as the chair of planning, and I've been a councillor for 6 years, like the Lord Mayor and the deputy and a couple others. We've seen many, many different applications. I mean, the City of Melbourne's planning team handles about 1,400 applications a year. So we see more infill occurring. And as Daniel says, consistent with the MSS, you know, while it's a stable area, we do see some infill coming in. And we try to make sure, and the officers, working closely with both the objectors and the applicants, try to make sure that everyone understands the scheme, the planning schemes, the objectives of the scheme, what are the rules, what are mandatory, what sort of discretion can be used, and then apply that. When this first came in January last year, it hit a number of obstacles. Through that process, the applicants gone back and did a lot of work. I can understand the objectors don't want any increased density in that street of, in Barnett Street. But when I look at the street and the buildings there, yes, there's a lot of the old style heritage. There's also been some mix, and there has been some density over the years, and not all the best. What's concerning me is that when the presenters come up here, they start to berate the officers for being incompetent, not following the rules. The officers here do the job professionally. And in the City of Melbourne, I believe, in what I've seen, they are some of the best planners and statutory planners and urban designers we have. We have the directors of the two areas who are well-renowned with the years of experience who actually oversee these areas, Professor Adams and Jeff Lawler. And yet, we get people coming in because of a change to the environment, berating some of our officers for them doing their job. I find that actually quite offensive. Secondly, when you put up presentation to us and you put up numbers and statements, my background is engineering and maths. You can put up any numbers and skew it any way to try to put an argument. But when you say other consultants have said this and this and this, please put those consultants' reports on the table so we can actually look at it. But there are all these architects and urban designers that have been quoted. I just would like to say that. Come here, present your case factually. All right? The other point here is, when I look at some of the particular points made, I know that some submitters, you might have a legal background and you can challenge the process we take. The point is this. If I'm an architect, I will have a different opinion to 10 other architects of what this building is good and bad. If I'm heritage advisors, and we have seen 3 or 4 heritage reports on a number of projects where they all contradict each other as well. The reality is this. The officers work within the scope of the system, the planning guidelines, and then prepare the recommendations. They spent months on this, and some people criticize them because it's too close to them. I can go on for a while longer, but I won't. But I will wind it up by saying, if this goes up, you still have the choice to go to VCAT to argue against council's decision. But remember, you are actually fighting the council in VCAT. You're not fighting the applicant. Because if it goes up, because many things is our recommendations. Anyway, I will put it back to the mover to make some closing comments.
Sorry, Chair, before you do, I'd like to speak against the motion.
Yes, Councillor Forster.
Thank you. Look, the particulars for and against have been articulated quite adequately, so I'm not going to repeat anything that's already been said. I just wanted to make the point that sometimes, as councillors, it is very, very difficult to go against the advice of officers. I think all of us here respect the professionalism of officers when they're making recommendations to us. So it is with some difficulty that I do that. But I think at the end of the day, as elected representatives, we have to remember the people who elected us. And when residents come to us with significant concerns about a development, they can be very, very difficult to ignore. Indeed, I found them impossible to ignore tonight. The wishes of residents, the effects on their lifestyle and their amenity in the end remain probably among the most important of considerations in applications like this. It's not to say for a second that officers' recommendations are poorly founded or anything like that. They're certainly not. They're actually really well founded. But as are some of the concerns of residents tonight. I'm not the one that has to live in the same street as a development like this that may well go ahead. It's for that reason I just think, well, if I was, what would I want my elected representative to do? Would I want them to represent my voice? Yeah, of course I would. So I hope that a few of us tonight can do that. And indeed, in the event that residents don't get the outcome that they want tonight, I would encourage you to utilise whatever other jurisdiction you have to make your voices heard.
Thank you, Councillor Forster. Would a mover like to close debate?
Oh, after 65 minutes and eight speakers, very, very briefly on a five dwelling application. Look, in terms of rolling, I'm not inclined to reject professional advice rather than rolling. And this is a quasi-judicial element of our role. It's a quasi-judicial element, these planning decisions. And I don't think we can just respond to volume of disagreement, understandable disagreement. Soon to be D is about as low as you can get in heritage. I'm not aware of a D we've saved that's come up here. I mean, when you're talking A and B and maybe a bit of C, but soon to be D, let's not die in a ditch over that one. On the Lord Mayor's comment about always in Kensington, I do remember an application last year, Lord Mayor, where you took a different position. It's great to have you back in the fold. And finally, 30 objections is significant, and that's why this is here tonight, because we have a trigger at 16. So we do need to take it seriously. But I think we've had a very lengthy debate. This has been gone uphill and down dale, and it's time to make a decision. And I think as Chair of Finance, I'm also very reluctant about throwing maybe $10,000 fighting our own officers at VCAT, probably to lose. And I think that for all of those reasons, plus the excellent setbacks that my colleague here described and the excellent site coverage and the conclusion from the officers that the proposed development is considered to fit in with the eclectic character found in the surrounding streetscape. I think we should support this one, councillors.
Thank you. Councillor Main. On that note, I'll put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. Lord Mayor, Deputy Lord Mayor, Councillor Ong, Councillor Main, Councillor Wood, Councillor Pinder-Mortimer, Councillor Louis. All those against the motion, raise your hands. Councillor Leppard, Councillor Oak, Councillor Watts, and Councillor Forster. I declare the motion carried.
Chair, I request that the reasons for opposition to this motion be recorded in the minutes in the form of the foreshadowed motion. Thank you.
So be it. Right. Next. Agenda item 6.1A. Planning application TP 2014-274, number 529 to 541 Elizabeth Street, Melbourne. This was deferred from last week. And so I'd like Daniel to just address the committee to update us on the changes since our meeting last week.
Sure. I don't have anything to present, Councillor Ong. An email was circulated at about 11:30 this morning from Urbis, which included, I think all the councils, should have been circulated to all councils. I asked that it was when I received it. It included a sectional diagram. Actually, if you can scroll through, I could probably describe what it is without actually having it in front of me. That one there, that will do. So what the sectional diagram effectively does is mimics the location of that red line, or that red outline, which was the proposal for under the conditions, and it flips the bottom to orange levels so that the simulation labs, which were previously on level 2, are on level 1, and it provides for a 2.5 metre setback to that simulation labs, which was something that I suggested as a possible alternative at the last meeting. It also includes a change to, if you can go, I think there's a roof plan perhaps, back a couple, this one here. It also proposed a change to the plant and the roof equipment, and the change was twofold. One was the 7 metre, have I got this the right way around? Yes, one was the 7 metre setback to Elizabeth Street, so it shows that, and it also shows a setback for the plant and equipment this is the light court on the adjoining property, I think that's the right location, shows a setback of 3 metres running all the way through to here and to 6 metres at about this point here. I think that's right. So that you should have that image, those images in front of you, that'll make more sense to you, I think.
Thank you. Now I have a number of speakers on this. I will call on the speakers in the order I have. You have 3 minutes. After 2 minutes, there'll be the timer will beep, and you have 1 minute to wind up. First of all, I call Graham Poole to address the committee.
Lord Mayor, councillors, ladies and gentlemen, we thank council in particular work done by Josephine Lee for the due consideration and your refusal to grant the application for the 5 additional stories to the existing hotel at 238 Victoria Street, thus keeping the heritage value of the iconic Victoria Market and its surroundings intact. Again, we are faced with a proposal that severely detracts from the heritage value of the Queen Victoria Market area. In fact, the latest application shares a property line with the previously refused 5-storey addition, yet this proposal has a far greater negative impact on the heritage place. The grossly oversized proposal results in casting shadows over the Queen Victoria Market during the winter solstice and detracts from the heritage precinct in many regards, a precinct where the City of Melbourne plans to spend up to $250 million to preserve and renew the Queen Victoria Market and seek UNESCO World Heritage listing. Quite rightly, Melbourne is known as one of the world's most livable cities. This in part is due to the feel of Melbourne with its cafes, laneways and cultural precincts. Together with the sport and arts, Melbourne is indeed a world-renowned city, and its livability is an asset to embrace and protect. The gateway from the north, Elizabeth Street, and the Queen Victoria Market should be protected for future generations to enjoy. Visitors come from all over Melbourne, regional Victoria, Australia, and overseas to enjoy this precinct. With regards to this application, parking is at full capacity and no compensation should be considered on any application in this precinct. Plant and equipment should not be placed on top of the building, creating an eyesore and excessive noise. As a priority, we request new buildings in the Queen Victoria Market precinct locate plant and equipment in their basement. I think it appropriate to limit the height of the structure to 6 storeys, retaining the historic facades on both Elizabeth Street and O'Connell Street and architecturally embracing those facades. As proud Melburnians, we sincerely request a suitable proposal to evaluate rather than a development that severely affects the significance of this heritage precinct. Thank you.
Thank you, Graham. Next, I call on Lloyd Elliott to address the committee.
Thank you, councillors, for the opportunity to present again to you. I'll be brief. We intend to talk about two issues. Obviously, we went away last week and resolved with our design team to look at an alternate balance between some of the competing educational requirements and also the heritage outcome desired by council officers. We also, secondly to that, sought to have a look at our roof plant area as well and go further again than what officers had suggested in that way. So, as you would have heard before from your planning officers, we put forward a scenario where the simulation lab has been flipped a level and we've moved that part out 2.5 metres. The remainder would be set back at the council officer recommended 4 metres across the length of the building. Complementing this change, we've also looked at a significant setback to the southern interface in terms of the plant area of up to 6 metres. So, in line with the council officer's recommendation that you heard last week, we say that we put forward a well-considered and balanced outcome, a 40-metre building in a nominated future 40-metre height control, and one that will provide the kind of facility needed for the ANMF to expand and provide a service for their nurses. And also, we say that this is an outcome that in many ways is aligned with your City North strategy adopted for council. There's been a range of matters that have been raised by the submissions and so forth. Most of those have been dealt with within the officer's report. But as always, if there's specific questions about the proposal, I'm more than happy to take them. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Lloyd. Any questions for the speaker? Thank you. Next, I call Judy Cowan to address the committee for 3 minutes.
Good evening. The applicant has a building directly across Elizabeth Street, which is far higher than those surrounding it. This building obviously pushed the limits pertaining to height levels and, interestingly, is now being cited as a nearby high-rise to justify 529. I refer to a quote in Saturday's Age entitled, "Going Up, the Rise of the High Life." Quote, "As more Melburnians swap backyards for city views, buyers can expect to see larger apartments with improved design." Unquote. However, this will not happen if the people being encouraged to live in the CBD and environs experience what is happening to us. Very quickly, this trend will come to an abrupt halt as apartment owners become built out and marginalised by a lack of good planning policies. The predominantly residential building at 222 Victoria Street is 31 metres in height. The proposed building is almost 50 metres including plant, which is two-thirds higher. Not only does it tower over our building, but it is wide and deep also. The bulk of it is breathtaking and completely out of place, especially as it is so close to the historic Queen Victoria Market. There will be no sunlight to the affected residents for most of the year, as permanent overshadowing occurs from about 9 o'clock in the morning. Natural light will be substantially diminished and only, can you move the slides on please? And only small glimpses of sky possible. I've been observing high-rise buildings in the city and environments and note most are standalone buildings separated from each other. 529 has its toilets deliberately jutting out to join with our northern wall up against bedrooms and lounge rooms, as previously explained. Noise from plant and toilets will also be introduced to our peaceful environment. The health and well-being of affected residents will be drastically impacted not only by this lack of sunshine and light, but being hemmed in with only 4 walls to look at. How the air will circulate or create a welcoming breeze, if at all, is an unknown, but certainly a lack of ventilation is an obvious problem. However, this proposed building not only affects us, but the wider community. I was recently at the Queen Victoria Market on a day when the sunshine was streaming across Victoria Street, People were happy and many families were sitting at tables outside the hotel of Connell Street, eating and drinking. And sunshine makes us feel good and is great for business. Considering the importance of this precinct, the tourism it attracts, and the $250 million council plans to spend on its revitalisation, this highly visible building with its overshadowing of Victoria Street will detrimentally affect the ambience of the area and how people feel, thus compromising council's investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. Next, I call on Belinda Burkamp to address the committee.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you this evening. My name is Belinda Burkamp. I'm a tenant at 222 Victoria Street. You don't normally hear from tenants, I expect, at planning, around planning applications. The reason for that is that my job is working in community engagement planning. So my initial interest was in seeing what it would be like as somebody affected by an application to go in and see what it was like. So when I had a look at the original proposal, and the question asked of me was, how does it affect me? The issues for me, I'm looking out to the south, is loss of daylight to skylights on the top floor, which affects sustainability. The other was, I was concerned about the impact of the open space and the tree on the ground floor with main link over to the Queen Victoria Market along Elizabeth Street. Then last week, I came along and I was listening to Judy and Lynn talk about the impacts on them. And I decided that I'd take a closer look at the application, the current and the proposed planning controls. I had a look at both panel reports and also some VCAT cases. So the key question that came up last week, was around community benefit and the question of net community benefit. And the officer report highlighted that as the responsible authority, the City of Melbourne should endeavour, and I quote, to integrate the range of policies relevant to the issues to be determined and balance conflicting objectives in favour of net community benefit and sustainable development for the benefit of present and future generations. There's been a number of VCAT cases in recent times which have looked at this in particular. Notably, there was a City of Melbourne refusal which was upheld near the Queen Victoria Market on Queen Street, which related to the impact on the market and heritage. And also a Minister for Planning approval in the Arden-Macaulay Structure Plan, which went against. So these are the key directions for the City North Structure Plan. So I had a quick look at what were the benefits and disbenefits. So we know that there's some benefits for in terms of new office space for AMF, new training space and auditorium, but there's also four or five levels of office space for lease, which we've seen there. We've also seen there's an impact on residential amenity. There's an impact on heritage in terms of loss of heritage buildings in Amendment C198, which is a seriously entertained document. And we've also got urban design. Both urban design and heritage referrals raise concerns with the application. In terms of mass, one of the issues with bulk is what we see here is the original proposal. I've got the current height limit under the mixed use zone and the proposed height limit under the 40. The red area is, if you take into account the heritage advice, what kind of built form you'd have. But I guess the real
Belinda,
question is community benefit.
Your time is up. Thank you for your presentation.
I had so many more slides.
you'll probably have to practice next time to time it.
I will practice. I thought I gave you more context.
Yeah. Thank you. You may take a seat.
Okay.
And next and final speaker is Lynn. Lynn Nicholson. You can address the committee for 3 minutes.
To the next slide. Thank you. Okay. This building was built in the middle of the 20th century, and it was built as the National Australia Bank. It is in an Art Deco style, and it still has its original windows, even though it was redeveloped in 1998. It went and came back. This is it. Do you want to do it for me? That'd be great. And go back one. Go back one, please. Yep, the next one, please. Thank you. Okay, there's light shine, there's light, sunshine, fresh air, privacy, security, and convenience, making it a great amenity in the world's most livable city. You can see the balconies jutting out there, and they'll all be blocked in, basically. Next slide, please. Thank you. It's an aerial shot, and shows skylights on the roof of and the north and east, west. North, east and west facing windows and also the balconies. Now, we need direct sunlight into our living areas and bedrooms, and the living areas are the north facing, directly north facing areas, and the bedrooms are on either side, east and west, where there won't be any light. Now, it's also difficult to get airflow into the apartment. I at times leave my balcony doors open overnight, and in the morning when I get up, I find that there's just a bit of air around, sort of just around the doorways. There's some fresh air there, but it's not all the way through unless it's been a really good wind. And so this will actually become worse, I think. Now, the ANMF proposal, the thing is, they are already in the area, and there's really no net community benefit to the building going up because they're already sitting there across the road. Next one, please. So we'll all be overwhelmed by this building, and I'm told that new buildings must comply with the environmental sustainability design, but that will be to our detriment because we will be less environmentally sustainable. As a consequence, we'll need to use more lighting, more heating and air conditioning to have air around our properties. Now, I've noticed that there's three levels of leased office. In this it says four, but this was the document that I had when I made this PowerPoint. But there are three levels of leased offices, and we're wondering why that's required. And we'd also like the plant to be put in the basement and also the building to be built further away because it's just too close and we won't get any light, we won't get any air. Now, the next one, please. That's shadowing. That's the 9 o'clock in the morning at 22nd of September. Now, in June, of course, it will be worse. And it comes all the way to the corner of Queen and Victoria Streets. Next slide, please. And then that's at 12 noon. And that is covering almost all of our building. And that's at 3 p.m., which covers all the building and goes into the intersection. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Yes, Daniel, could you... Now, in the earlier the diagram that from the sketch that we received from the applicant today, the southern walls for the plant room...
Yes.
My recollection from last week's discussion and Councillor Leppard concurs that the intention was to have the 3 meter setback for the whole length up to the point where the light well for the neighbouring building is and then to set it back 6 meters from there.
That wasn't an officer recommendation. So you're probably asking the question of the wrong person. You might better ask the question of Councillor Leppard. I think that was a foreshadowed alternative motion. So,
but the understanding is that the 3 meter setback was the entire length, right?
That is how I understood Councillor Leppard's alternative motion.
And then I might need to ask the first presenter, or second presenter, Lloyd, to clarify that particular point in the documentation sent through today. that was drawn by Crown Partners. Yes, it shows... Yes, that's the one. On the southern boundary, it starts at 3, it juts out to the boundary, then it drops back to 3 and then drops to 6. We were discussing last week that the entire length should be 3 for the plant room. Yes. Okay. Thank you, Daniel. You can take a seat. All right. On that note, I'm happy to put up a recommendation, alternative recommendation for this particular application. I'll let everyone read it a bit. I'll ask for a councillor to second this.
Chair, I'm either happy to suggest a change and second it if you're happy with it, or wait for a seconder and then make a suggested amendment.
Yeah, I'm happy to go with that.
All right, at the very end of the motion, please, can we put a comma there and say, but with the 3-metre setback continuing the full length of the southern boundary wall? And before I say that that's what I'd like to suggest, can I just ask Daniel if that is going to do what we need it to do, to provide a minimum 3-metre setback, the full length of the plant. Do you think it will? Thank you, Daniel. There you go, my music degree came in handy. I will second it on that basis, Chair.
I'm happy to accept that change and... Oh, the setback, yes. That is. Yeah, 12.1, yep, and 12.2, and that one. Yep, correct.
No?
The 3-metre setback is one. Oh, that's 3-metre setback. That's a noun. That's a noun. Okay. As before, I thank our submitters. I understand the both Judy and Lynn and Belinda, because I guess Belinda is one of those interesting, considering you spent a bit of time doing the research. And I think from what Lynn and Judy have said, and we've heard you last week, there are issues because of the, yeah, on the other side, the north side of the building, which has more impact, and which is why we're trying to increase some setbacks to allow at least the impact of the plant room. Now, I understand that, yes, it's a large building, but generally, excluding the plant room, it complies with the city north plans. And I think the officers have gone through this in quite detail, and then we pushed back quite a bit on what the original application wanted. I do acknowledge that when it comes to the heritage component, the recommendation from the heritage consultant was to try to get 8 metres back, but based on the type of building we have on both Elizabeth and Nicholson, O'Connell, it was decided that 4 metres will do the job, from the point of where you are when you're at a street level. Because one of the most important part of trying to analyze some of these is how the street level activation and the amenity is. So if we have the setback of 4 meters as was presented last week, you basically can see the front of the old heritage building, but you can't really see the top. You can see the top across the road in Elizabeth Street, which is a 45 meter wide road, which is a pretty big road. And therefore, in terms of that context, the actual 40 meter building is not an overbearing bulk compared to a 250 meter building. I won't speak too much more. I think we've had quite a lot of chat. I'll let my esteemed seconder, Councillor Leppett, to say a few words.
I wasn't esteemed in the last debate, Chair. Point of order, Chair. Can I thank everyone involved for, over the course of the last week, submitting those new amended plans and sketches. I think that has facilitated the potential decision that we could make tonight. This is, of course, an application in an urban renewal area, so it's right off the other end of the scale to the application we were considering in the previous instance. And so the expectations about what can be built in this area are very, very different. City North, C196, is all but signed off. We're just waiting the planning minister to recover to full health. And so the expectation that this is a 40-metre height limit area is strong, and that scheme has undergone a lot of community consultation. The building to the south is has that light well, which is designed to be built out, and that is a very difficult thing, I know, to concede for those who live there and are accustomed to one particular view and access to light. And so what we have to do now is, given that this is going to be a 40 metre height limit area, do everything that we can to make sure that we're using the tools that we have to make that interface as sympathetic as possible. So whilst my suggested amendment here is about making sure that the bulk of the building is not overwhelming, and so that it appears from the south and the southeast, if you like, to be a 40 metre building as opposed to a 40 metre building plus the plant, which looks like another two levels. So I think it will now look a bit more like a 40 metre building. It will also have the added benefit of removing some of the bulk away from the top of the light well, which I hope will, I know it won't go to anywhere near to the extent that some will be happy with, but it will go some way towards making life better for those who rely on that light well for solar access. And so that's the purpose of the amendment. Given that this is an urban renewal area and the purposes of this built form are so important, that is why we can tolerate other things such as the one that I'm very uncomfortable about, which of course is the demolition of the currently ungraded but proposed to be C-graded building. The other building, of course, is going to be retained. But given that this is the urban renewal area and the purposes are important on balance, I can just support this, especially given that my colleagues, I hope, are about to support another tweak to the amended motion before us. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Councillor Leppett. Any other councillors like to speak to the motion? Councillor speaks against the motion. In that case, it's back to me, the mover. Since there's no debate, I'm happy to put this to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. I declare it carried unanimously. Thank you all. And now I call on Councillor Foster to assume the role of chair of the meeting in relation to the People's City portfolio.
Thank you, Councillor Ong. There's one report from management for consideration under the People's City portfolio, agenda item 6.2. Melbourne for All People 2014-17 implementation monitoring and evaluation plan. Given that the matter's been before the Future Melbourne Committee once before, I might call on Jane Foley to give us a brief verbal presentation as to what work has been completed since the last time this has been before us. Thank you, Jane.
Okay. Lord Mayor and Councillors, the purpose of this report tonight is to give you a background on the work that's been undertaken since we presented Melbourne for All People in November of last year. Just as background, we presented the original report to you in August of last year, and we were asked to come back to FMC in November with a more detailed implementation plan. The work that has occurred over the last couple of months has been really focusing on the actions and deliverables in this report, and there are 135 deliverables over the next 3 years. So in the evaluation plan, we've detailed the measures and targets. For the measures and targets for core business, they're well underway. For the measures and targets for new initiatives, we're in the process of establishing the baseline data for those particular initiatives. And I think that's probably all that I need to say, except that by June of this year, there will be a report provided to councillors and to the community, and that will be put up on the City of Melbourne's website. So are there any questions?
It doesn't appear so. Thank you, Jane, Thank very you. Much for that. Okay, so I'll move the recommendation on the screen. Is there a seconder? Thank you, Councillor Leppert. Jane has already spoken to this, obviously, and again, as the matter has already been before us, I won't speak for too long, but I just wanted to pay special mention and thanks to Councillor Rong, and for, even though he's not in the room at the moment, for his contribution through the Disability Advisory Committee through officers and into this plan that integrates some four plans now into one and drives a new direction, I guess, of how we deliver community services in the city. It does bring a focus to a whole of life access to and participation in the services we offer as a local government, with a particular emphasis on safety and wellbeing, but also on inclusion, connection and lifelong learning. So whether you're an infant in Melbourne or whether you're, well, older than an infant in Melbourne, Melbourne for All People will be relevant to you. Would anybody, Councillor Leffert, would you like to speak to the motion?
Thank you, Chair. Can I also thank officers for all the extra work that this committee asked them to do? I know that wasn't necessarily in the plan, but that has now come about. The reason for that, of course, was so that we can have a bit more of an understanding about how we're going to measure whether or not this strategy is successful. And I think the officers have done a remarkable job in breaking down the components of Melbourne for All People and the implementation plan and explaining how success will be measured. And I think, therefore, that it's going to be a much more dynamic process than it maybe otherwise would have. And I hope that the creation of this document itself has been a good step along that road. How long is a piece of string? I mean, this is such a large document, you never know when to stop trying to tweak it, and I'm going to not alarm my colleagues and I'll say I'll stop trying to tweak it now. Thank you, Chair. I think it's a good document.
Thank you, Councillor Leppert. Would any other councillor like to speak in favour of the motion? Any councillor against? In that case, I'll put the motion. All those in favour? It's carried unanimously. I'll now call on Councillor Main to assume the role of Chair of the meeting in relation to the Finance and Governance Portfolio.
Thanks, Councillor Foster. There are two reports from management under the Finance and Governance Portfolio. The first is Agenda Item 6.4, which is the December quarter financials for the Council. And I'd like to first call on CFO Phil Nguyen to make a brief presentation. Lucky Phu.
Thank you, Councillor Main, and good evening, Lord Mayor, Deputy Lord Mayor and Councillors. Through you, Chair, the purpose of the report is to present the financial performance of the Council to the 31st December 2014 and provide you with information on supplementary valuations adopted by the previous CEO under delegation. As reflected in the report, halfway through the financial year, we are well positioned to deliver on the Council's full-year budget with the underlying surplus of $23.4 million versus a budget of $13 million. Having said that, I expect that through the second half of the year, as planned projects and programs are delivered, that the positive variance will diminish and Council will deliver a result more in line with the underlying surplus, full-year underlying surplus of $6.4 million. On the revenue side, budget is on track or ahead of budget on the major revenue streams, including rates. We're ahead by $1.1 million, parking fines by $600,000 and parking fees by $1.7 million. Notably, the Council is also well ahead on open space contributions. For the first 6 months, we've received $9.8 million. Against a budget of $900,000. That is significantly higher than historical averages, and the six-month figure is actually higher than any annual amount we've received over the preceding 7 years. Given the additional revenue, the unallocated component of the open space reserve at the 31st December now sits at $14 million. That will obviously be a subject of discussion for future budget deliberations for councillors.
In terms of unfavourable variances, subsidiary revenue is lower than budget by $637,000. Interest revenue is also lower by $198,000, predominantly due to lower cash balances and the settlement of, the deposit on the Munro site. In terms of the full year forecast, overall revenue expected to be above budget. And on the expenditure side, as I've mentioned earlier, we are low across most of the categories, but I do expect that to diminish as the programs and projects are delivered in the second half of the year. On our cash balances, the December cash balance is at $64.6 million. We've had a net cash outflow of $34.7 million in the first 6 months. That's predominantly related to the capital works and again the deposit on the Munro site. You'll see a tick up in the cash balances in January and February as the rain installments come in. The recommendation from management is that the Future Mail Committee accepts the quarterly financial performance report. Thank you.
Ms. Fu, any questions, councillors?
I save that for special occasions, Lord Mayor.
Well, I've got two quick questions. First one is, Fu, asset sales at $900,000. What have we sold, and are there any other unbudgeted asset sales in the works?
By far the largest asset sale we've had in the first half is a sale of a parcel of land at 2 Riverside Quay. It's approximately 46 metres squared, and that was sold for $768,000 to Mirvac. In the second half of the year, there is a potential sale. It is located at the rear of 6872 Collins Street. All things going to plan, that will be settled in April.
The other question was I know Crown, our biggest ratepayer, took us to VCAT challenging the rates. And that seems to have worked out on page 20 of 20. The hit, could you just summarise? There's two mentions of the Crown site and two different figures, one $380,000 hit, the other $255,000 hit. Could you just clarify if that's 1 year, 2 years? You know, what's the overall loss of revenue from that VCAT decision?
The objections you're referring to are the Crown land site. It relates to the 2012 general valuation. There are multiple assessments there. Dispute was resolved in VCAT. Supplementary valuation returned in October 2014. The total rate reduction for the period, for the two-year period, is $636,541, as detailed in the report.
Right, for the 2 years. So it's $300 a year.
That's over the two-year period.
Two years, yeah, great. Okay. All right, thank you. Yes, Councillor Ong.
On page 19, it shows basically October, November, and December in terms of supplementary rates. The change in the NAV was $53,482,581. What was the actual total value of all these completions? It looks like it's a pretty large amount in terms of new completions that have come on board into the change in the last 3 months of the year.
Greg? I'm going to take that question on notice unless Greg can help me out here. In terms of the supplementary valuations, Greg, the NAV has changed by $53 million. Change in the rate base total.
Through you, Lord Mayor. Chair. The $53 million is the net increase in the total rate base. Yes.
In terms of when we look at NAV, it's a percentage of the total increase in the built base. Do we have the valuation of that?
I'll take it on notice, but the capital improved value has increased incrementally as well. We only report the net annual value in this report.
So
all three values, capital value and net annual value have increased, yes.
So the CRV has actually gone up quite a bit.
Oh, yes. Sorry?
Councillors, in rough terms, given that the 5% yield on the NAV, if you times it by 20, you'll get roughly $1 billion. It will vary depending, obviously, on some of those other properties, but in broad terms, that's the figure.
Okay, thanks, Fu. Any other questions? Okay, I'm happy to move the officer report on the screen. Is there a seconder? Councillor Wong. Okay, just like to thank the officers. A beautiful set of numbers. $10 million ahead of budget for the half, heading for $1 million ahead of the final budget, so heading for 7.36 versus the 6.4. The rates being favourable, obviously the supplementaries with things like Emporium and big projects like that coming on, we're doing well with the supplementaries. Interesting that even our car towing fees are up $390,000 for the half. So we're obviously towing a lot of people away at the moment. Not material, Lord Mayor, not material. I don't think we've towed LM00 yet, but maybe we will. In terms of adverse numbers, interesting, there is numbers in here which do bear out the record growth that we are having. So cleaning and coin collecting at $500,000 over budget is just the growth of the city. It's not a poorly handled contract, it's just the volume that we're seeing with that. So, and the cash balance is down to $64.5 million, and it will be diminished in net terms with the Munro settlement. So we've got probably two more quarter reports of a good cash balance, and then after 20 years with a pile of cash, we'll be going into debt as we crank up for the Queen Vic market. So all up, thanks to the officers, excellent numbers. We're in good shape, strong financial position, and keep up the good work. Councillor Wrong. Lord Mayor, would you like to speak? Okay, anyone else like to speak? Okay, all those in favour? Any against? Declare that carried. Unanimously. The next item of business is agenda item 6.5, the allocation of the discretionary fund second quarter 2014-15. I'm happy to move the motion on the screen. Is there a seconder? Councillor Wood. I have no comments. Councillor Wood.
Nothing to add, Chair.
Anyone like to speak on this one, Lord Mayor? Okay, all those in favour? Any against? Declare that carried. Back to you, Lord Mayor.
Six items of general business to be speedily considered. Are we happy to move the travel motions en bloc? In that case, I'm happy to move the travel, the three travel reports en bloc. Seconded, Councillor Wood. I would just note in moving that we don't send people away without purpose, but in each case, these have been remarkably economic trips. I noticed the Deputy Lord Mayor's trip to Barcelona cost us the princely sum of $628.
Can I go again?
No. I noticed the trip by Councillor Pinder Mortimer to Guangzhou in China cost us $195. So I don't think we're actually overspending on travel just at the minute. Anyway, I'm happy to move all three en bloc. Councillor Wood.
I won't add too much, Lord Mayor, just to say that some of the commentary around this is a very easy kick, really, and it's probably something to be expected, but international travel, particularly for business purposes, for the world's most livable city is absolutely critical, and I think it just shows the diversity of travel that goes on and what is brought back from those trips, whether it's new business, whether it's interns that are going to come and work at the city, whether it's exchanges, whether it's conferences, whether it's events, it's absolutely very important that we keep outward looking as well as inward looking.
Further contribution to debate? Yes. Thank you, Councillor Mann.
I did notice a rather churlish piece in the Herald Sun this morning on travel, and I'd just like to make the point that as a shareholder in News Corp, I note that they have private jets to get around. And with absolutely no disclosure whatsoever. So here we're very transparent. We fly on regular airlines. We don't have to have our own jets to get around. And quite a contrast to
happy to entertain a notice of motion.
The people in those people in those glass houses. Great idea. All right, that'll do.
In that case, I will put the motion. All those in favour, that is carried unanimously. My belief is I move 1, 2, and 3 on block, but. To propose travel by Councillor Pinder Mortimer, I think we should do that separately. So I'm happy to move that motion. Is there a seconder? Councillor Wood. Thank you. I think the motion stands for itself. The only thing I would say is I don't think we can match what Sydney do for Chinese New Year, given it's 2 weeks and they spend in the millions in order to celebrate it. But it's worth sending someone to have a look at some of the ideas we might pick up on in particular to improve what is a growing festival. And I note with some regret that it is concurrent with White Night this year and therefore gets a little lost as a separate festival. But never mind that. That's just an accident of this year's dates. But I'm happy to move that. Councillor Wood, further contribution to debate? I'll put that motion. All those in favour? Carried unanimously. Thank you. Could I move to the notice of motion by Councillor Oak, Sunlight to Public Places? And can I call on... I wrote down It's not Paul, is it? It is Michelle, who wishes to speak to us in relation to this agenda item. Thanks, Michelle. You have 3 minutes, Michelle, and a bell sounds at two to let you know you've got 1 minute remaining. Thank you.
There we go. We are supporting the review of the Sunlight to Open Spaces clause in the Melbourne Planning Scheme. In this review, we think there are three main items that should be looked at. One is the overshadowing concerns of the Yarra River, particularly on the South Bank, considering some of the recent decisions that have impacted upon that area. So we think that the review should look into that very closely. Secondly, we think that there are issues concerning Melbourne's public gardens, given that they are not explicitly named in the clause, so that there is there's an issue that they could be impacted on, especially as they are also only given protection at the equinox and not the solstice, so that's the 22nd of September, rather than the 22nd of June, as the Yarra and other public spaces in Melbourne are. So we think that it might be useful to consider explicitly naming gardens within the city, particularly Flagstaff, considering some of the recent developments that have put pressure on overshadowing on Flagstaff Gardens. And thirdly, we think it's really important that the planning scheme gives solid guidance to developers and decision makers on when a permit will be granted and when it won't be granted. At the moment, we've seen a spate of decision making in high-rise developments in the city of Melbourne that have impacted upon public space and public amenity and sunlight to those open spaces. And for future planning decisions need to be guided for public amenity and to protect the open space that makes this city so livable. So in conclusion, we support reviewing this clause, and in particular protecting the Yarra River, our public gardens and the open space that make Melbourne so important. Thank you.
Michelle, are there any questions for Michelle? Thank you, and thank you for your patience in waiting for so long to make that submission. Thank you very much. Could I call on Councillor Lorick to move the motion standing in her name?
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I move the motion standing in my name.
Is there a seconder for that motion, Councillor Leppard? Thank you, Councillor Lorick.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Michelle has eloquently summed up the reasons why I've brought forward this motion. In particular, the stated objectives of this clause within the Melbourne Planning Scheme is fairly impossible to achieve with the current mechanisms before us, and it's fairly inconsistent in, I guess, the perception of what we can do with overshadowing and what we can actually do within the planning scheme, and that has unfortunately been seen in some of the decisions that we've had to support, given the guidelines around protection of particular spaces within the city, in particular, as already been mentioned, our heritage gardens, parks and gardens, and other public spaces. Tonight we've heard about overshadowing of QVM, the Queen Victoria Market, but it's not specified in the public spaces, whereas Federation Square, Queensbridge Square, the State Library, City Square are, but other important spaces could be considered as part of this review from management. And I also agree that this review should look at the adequacy of only specifying September in general and June or winter in other areas such as the south bank of the Yarra River. So it's it's well time that we review this policy and see what we can do to ensure that our parks and gardens, our public spaces and our streets, which are very important public spaces, especially in a very dense city, that we look at what we can do within the planning mechanisms to protect sunlight to public spaces, and not just at one point in the year, but across the year. And that's what I ask management to review when they're looking at the adequacy of this clause and in their recommendations that come back in April.
Councillor Leppard.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just pick up on the submission as well. So currently the 22nd of June test applies to the South Bank of the Yarra, which is a prohibition. It also applies to the Federation Square, City Square, Queensbridge Square and State Library forecourt, which is a should, not a must. Prior to 99 though, that 22nd of June test also applied to Flagstaff Gardens, Parliament Gardens, Treasury Gardens and Batman Park. I understand that the reason for the policy change in 1999, which in hindsight may have been lamentable, was that whilst the squares and plazas in the middle of the city are used a lot, particularly in the middle of winter, the gardens aren't used as much in the middle of winter. However, they're used more in the spring and autumn equinoxes, and of course much more in the summer. And that is why the shadowing test moved from June to September. The objectives of the policy broadly stayed the same, but because the tests changed, we do need from time to time to check that the mechanisms inside the policy do continue to meet the objectives of the policy, and that's why I think the way the motion's been constructed, it's very good. It's about testing the objectives of the policy, not just thinking about whether or not we should come up with a few new mechanisms. The objectives are first and the mechanisms need to follow. Before 99, of course, though, there wasn't any tests for other spaces, so parks and gardens across the municipality didn't have any particular overshadowing test mechanisms in place, and so there was an improvement there. But I make the point that there was a pretty blunt policy change in 99, but times have changed. We're now, as Councillor Mayne said earlier, the fastest growing municipality in the country. We've got a lot of apartment occupiers, more so than ever before, so open space is more important than ever before. And so that's why I think we do need to review this now. It has been 16 years. The other reason I think it would be good is that every architect in town that makes planning submissions to us now has and should have plans which model shadowing comprehensively. And so now that we can do more effective shadowing modelling and expect everyone else to do that, maybe it's time that we can have a bit more of a nuanced, complicated maybe policy. But that's the second thing. The first thing to do is to agree to this, I think, that Councillor Oak has put up so that we can kick off this review, which I think is an incredibly important review. Thank you, Councillor Oak.
Thank you. Is there a further speaker to the motion? Councillor Wood.
I'm happy to support this motion. I think the review is the right place to start because, as Councillor Leppard has highlighted, it could be a quite complex outcome in terms of how you respond to the review, but I think Councillor Oak's motion is a good one. This type of protection, I guess, this overshadowing protection is one of the genuine ways to protect existing public open space. And obviously we're seeing more and more with very tall buildings and very high density that open space is increasingly at risk from being in shadow, particularly those ones that Councillor Leppard mentioned in our submitter mentioned, like Flagstaff Gardens and some of our heritage gardens, I think are definitely needing review. Further to that, it'll be interesting to see what's said about our open space on our streets. Councillor Oak mentioned that. You only have to be on our east-west streets in winter. If it's a nice sunny day, they're quite cold and can be quite dark. Our north-south streets, though, will still get that dappled sunlight. So it brings a completely different feel as you step around the corner from Burke Street into Swanston Street on a day like that. So sunlight is integral, particularly in those colder months.
Any further contributions to the debate? Let me make one. I also support this, but I do so with one caveat. We may disagree with statutory measurement points and when they are, but nevertheless, when they've been in place for a long time, then you can't just move them with impunity because people have made substantial investment and substantial plans on the basis of the rules as they are. I mean, the golden rule of any planning scheme is certainty. And one thing this may start is a lack of certainty in the planning scheme around when we measure shadowing. That's not to say we shouldn't look at it. The difficulty is about the 1999 decision, it actually loosened the regulations. It gave a right of way. And what has been suggested in debate so far is we take some of that back. Now, that's a difficulty because people have made investments on the basis of how things were, and we may want to remove some of that right. So I just flag that now to say I want to look at the concept of certainty in planning depending on what this report brings back. The interesting thing to me is the major ones we've mentioned, including the South Bank of the Yarra, which we have voted against here, have been breached and breached since the 1990s by, for instance, buildings such as the Rialto. I'm delighted that 555, which breached that rule without any net benefit to us, has been withdrawn with a view to redrawing that particular building. And I was delighted at that, but that was not of our doing. There was a planning permit issued. The only other one which has been protected, I think, has been pointed out, is the forecourt of the library. and there is actually an extant planning permission from the minister to overshadow that forecourt. Again, we oppose that, but it highlights that I think we need to be careful about providing certainty. I think we're going to have to look carefully at what it means for us to rein this in from 1999 because of investments that people have made. And finally, we have to be realistic that as long as there is ministerial discretion to overrule us, which there always is, in fact, that has been done time and time again. That might be regrettable, but I, with all of those caveats, I'm happy to support this notice of motion. Any further speakers? Councillor Oak, do you wish to conclude debate?
Thanks, Lord Mayor. Just quickly to thank colleagues for supporting this review, and I do look forward to what it says and the recommendations from officers. And I guess I just point out, because we've spoken a lot about public spaces and plazas and the like, and parks and gardens, but one of the objectives says to achieve a comfortable and enjoyable street environment for pedestrians, and I just ask officers to play close consideration to that objective and whether the measures that are before us adequately protect pedestrians, not just at the regular street level, because sunlight in our city is very, very important, and too many of our streets, I believe, are becoming quite dark and quite overshadowed, and there is not much sunlight getting in.
Thank you. I'll now put the motion. All those in favour? That is carried unanimously. Thank you. I move to motion 7.6, a motion from Councillor Mayne on land tax, the fire services levy and congestion tax. Carl Fitzgerald has asked to address us. Carl, I'd invite you to do so now. And thank you for your forbearance and patience in getting to this point.
Yes, with an exciting discussion on land tax to finish us off. So Carl Fitzgerald from Prosper Australia. We're an NGO that's been around for 130 years trying to maintain this effective rating base, and we're very concerned about the Andrews government rate pegging announcement and fear the challenge that will place on the sovereignty of councils, especially councils such as Melbourne, which is growing at such a rapid rate. And we fear this is going to push councils towards the greater utilisation of user charges. Mm-hmm. That will increase the regressive, that will lead to further regressive pressures on the poor, and from that, the handballing of responsibilities down to local government level. The needy will require more services. So we are pleased that you're firing this shot across the bowels of the state government to say, at least, come on, guys, this is a bad move. We've seen what's gone on in New South Wales for the last 25 years. 26% of their councils are considered in some sort of poor sustainable financial sustainability, and it's about 90% are either poor or neutral, so they've really suffered from this rating peg. The people who are really celebrating about this move are property speculators who will be enjoying lower holding charges on these incredible capital gains that continue to roll on here in Australia. And also the Abbott government, who is wanting to, I feel, remove the independence of local councils. And Andrews has fallen into line. So with greater user charges, there's going to be a need for more federal grants. And from that, the push for the increase of the GST will continue. So we're interested to see how this plays out, but we'd like Melbourne City Council to keep applying some pressure, because you guys at least here have paid a lot of your infrastructure off, but it's those growth areas councils that are really going to be struggling to meet the sort of demands that they face, especially when the development contribution plans, the payments for those are spread out over 30 years plus. So for the whole local council movement, we feel this is a bad development and not something that the world's most livable city needs. Thank you.
Questions for Carl? Thank you for your contribution, Carl. Could I call on Councillor Mayne to move the motion standing in his name?
So moved.
Is there a seconder for that motion? Councillor Long. Thanks, Councillor Mayne.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. Look, I did note that our submitter, not our oral submitter, but a verbal written submitter, Dr. Lucy Firth, was slamming the motion for not explaining what on earth we're doing and why we want it and what is the broader political reasons and all this sort of stuff. So for Lucy, hello on the audio. The reason is that we've got rate capping, we've got a budget to hand down in May, we've got decisions to make about differential rates. At the moment, business pays 17% more than residential, and we have a history of revenue grabbing by Spring Street. So what I want to do is try and get some data that will inform the community and inform our decisions. And I had a quick look at the state budget today, and their land tax revenue in the current year is budgeted to rise by 22%, or $340 million to $1.9 billion. Back when I was the Treasurer's Press Secretary 20 years ago, it was less than $400 million. So they have had a massive revenue grab on land tax. They haven't changed the rate in the dollar level, particularly materially, whereas at City of Melbourne, we've lowered the rate in the dollar from a peak of 13 to currently around the 4.3. So every time valuations go up, we lower the rate in the dollar so that we don't hit our residents with much of a slug, whereas the state, effectively with bracket creep, has been absolutely clobbering everyone on land tax. So what I want to find out is how much of that $1.9 billion is coming from City of Melbourne landowners. So we've got 94,000 rateable properties overall, and the split is 72,000 residential, mainly exempt, because residential, primary place of residence, you don't pay land tax, and 22,000 commercial. And my best guess, but no idea, look forward to the data, is that we'll probably be 15 to 20% of that $1.9 billion. Then you've got the fire services levy, where we know we're shelling out, our ratepayers, mainly business, are shelling out about $40 million of the $610 million that the government makes. And then the congestion tax, parking in the inner city, budgeted to be $122 million this year. I'd best guess, again, is that we'd be probably $70 or $80 million of that. So all up, very round numbers. We're looking forward to seeing the actual data come in, but I reckon that the state is probably helping themselves to between $400 and $500 million from our landowners in the City of Melbourne, at the same time as we are only taking $230 million from them on the budget this year. So we are very light touch in our taxing of landowners, and the state is absolutely helping themselves to us. They're probably taking double. And now they're about to introduce a rate capping regime that will limit our ability to actually increase rates above CPI, starting in the year after next. So we need to have a significant debate about this. We need to get some data to inform us. We've got decisions to make about burdens between residential and non-residential, and look forward to this report coming back. And I'd also like to thank the officers, Greg, Stephen and Mark Stormer, for assisting in the working up of this motion into a palatable form that they could handle. And my final point is that over the last 15 years, we're the only council in Victoria that has not increased its rates by more than CPI over that period. So we have a tremendous record in terms of low tax, and so rate capping being hurled at us, and a letter from the Minister recently warning us not to put our rates up, in the context particularly of the land tax grab and the hits that our ratepayers have suffered, I think it's all a bit rich, and look forward to receiving the data to inform both the community and the government, and certainly hope that the First Andrews budget does not include any more property tax slugs on particularly our commercial ratepayers who have copped it between the eyes big time in recent years.
Councillor Rong.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I think the move of Councillor Mayne's pretty much covered everything.
Excellent. Is there a further speaker to debate? Councillor Leavitt.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, I'll speak slightly longer than the previous speaker. The mover, I agree with this motion. I think it's a good motion because I'm always in favour of collecting more data and presenting interesting data. I'm nervous with where it's going, though. I note, Councillor Mayne, you mentioned many times that we're looking at a land tax grab here, and I think that's true. But you also mentioned at the very end of the comments the differential in the commercial and residential rates we apply in the City of Melbourne. When I put the two together, I'm nervous about where the collection of this data may lead us, or where you'd like it to lead us. And so I'm hedging my bets a little bit with Lucy here, I think. I'm not sure where we're going with it. But on the basis that more information and more reports, I always support that. I do like a report. I'm happy to support it.
I can only concur with the mover and with the submitter that the rate capping regime currently being drawn up by the Labor government based on the failed Labor rate capping machine implemented by the Kennett government and the current New South Wales Liberal government is going to be a diabolically stupid thing for councils that are going to have to deal with it. I know it will hit regional and rural councils harder than it will hit us, but their CPI bears no relation to the real costs of councils' expenditure. And so whilst we should always be making sure that the rate burden is as only as high as it ever needs to be, the rate capping regime is ridiculous. And if some of this data can further demonstrate that in our campaign against the rate capping program, then I can only support that.
Is there a further speaker to the debate? Does the mover wish to conclude debate? In that case, I'll put the motion. All those in favour? Unanimously carried. Thank you. This concludes the items of general business for consideration. Are there any items of proposed urgent business? We provide a 15-minute period at the end of our meetings for members of the public to ask questions, or our own staff to ask questions, for that matter. what was all that about doesn't count as a question. Would anyone like to ask us a question? In that case, could I thank the public, management and staff for their interest in attendance and declare the meeting closed at 7:51 p.m.